I never sat down and said, I'll be self-employed by X stage. It genuinely happened in the most natural, organic evolution of a way, to the point that it probably held me back in business, because it didn't start with a business plan or, you know, understanding my demographic or the sector or the opportunity. That was just, it was from mommy and daddy's dining room table that it all started, with a notepad and pen.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today is a woman who has built a successful business while navigating some of life's toughest challenges and its most uplifting moments. Jennifer Rock, known to many as the Skin Nerd, is the founder of a leading online skincare consultancy and her own product range, Skingredients. She began her career as a teenager while also balancing life as a young mother. Since then, Jennifer has faced a diagnosis of endometriosis, the loss of a parent, and undergone a hysterectomy, all while still in her 30s. But alongside those trials, she's also experienced the joy of marrying the love of her life, Jill Deering. Today's conversation will explore resilience, passion, and the determination to keep going through it all, the highs and the lows. Jennifer Rock, you're welcome to the Insights podcast.
Thank you so much, Sean.
Can you take us back, first of all, to when this idea for the Skin Nerd first came to you?
Oh my goodness, great question. I've generally always adored skincare. I suffered with my own skin as a teenager, not to the degree of wanting or needing medical attention, but also, when was I a teenager? The late 90s, early 2000s. So going to the doctor about your skin wasn't really a reality then either, but it's been a lifelong passion. And so I worked in the sector, goodness, I'd been working in skincare maybe 15, 16 years at this stage, when I started realising that people really believed that they had to use one skincare product. So this was in the days where you had to go to the local pharmacy or go to, you know, the department store, and you'd use the cleanser, the toner, the serum, the moisturiser, everything from a particular brand. And I suppose the joy of having been in the skincare sector, working mainly as an educator, so I worked an awful lot in London at the time for particular brands, and I was working alongside nutritionists and pharmacists and plastic surgeons, and you started to realise that sometimes some brands, what was happening is they were excellent at creating a particular formula. So example, they'd be great at moisturisers, but they wouldn't be great at cleansers, or their formulas wouldn't be on par. So I started to notice that you didn't actually have to use everything from the one brand. It was a very clever marketing strategy, and it was a retention strategy, as is the skincare sector. If you look at it, it's turned over $1 billion in Ireland alone in 2024 across personal beauty and care. It's a huge sector. And so it's in the brand's best interest to keep you within their remit. And I suppose what I noticed was that just wasn't necessary. And so I wanted to educate people as to, you know, where to invest their money, where to invest their time, potentially where they didn't need to. So example, I would encourage people to spend money on serums, because they have active ingredients that are truly scientific that will actually alter the health of the skin, as opposed to just feeling nice. Whereas maybe your cleanser that's on and off the skin, its sole purpose is exactly that, to cleanse. You don't need to spend that much time for it. So to answer your question, it was through all these observations over many years then that I thought, God, I'd love to set something up that was unbiased, wasn't specifically married to one brand, and could educate people in an impartial sense. They didn't have to spend a lot of money. And that was the idea. It started off on Snapchat, so I have a lot to thank social media for. My goodness, I don't think I would have started without it. And it just became a genuine community of back and forth, trust built. And then the Skin Nerd, as we now know it, which is an element of a store and an element of a consultation service. So we've since served 65,000 clients over the last few years, just one-to-one education, all online, where it's almost like a skin personal trainer where we teach you what to do.
So and it's not just you personally, if you've got tens of thousands of people.
No, so the early days, the very early days, maybe the first few weeks only, it was myself on consultations. But when we launched, which is nearly 7 years ago now, we booked out, I think it was 6 or 7 months we booked out with just myself. So I had quickly hired others and others and others. So now there's a team of 28 of us all together, not just solely doing consults, but the whole business in its entirety, all the skills that I need to bring it together.
Was it a natural and perhaps even an inevitable progression that you moved on to your own product range, Skingredients?
That came truly from listening to our clients. So at this stage, I would say we maybe had done consultations of 3,000-4,000 clients. And what started becoming the norm there, and I was lucky enough to have, I suppose, do a lot of media and TV and radio. and through my social media that I'd have a lot of the same questions come through. So the frequently asked questions were, where do I apply SPF? Do I need SPF? What order?
Sorry, that stands for?
Sorry, SPF stands for sun protection factor. So what many might associate with like their summer holidays and the sun cream and, you know, the picnic on the beach with the ham sandwiches, and that's when the SPF or the sun cream comes out. But I suppose what was happening was people weren't sure of what order to apply products. Did they really need a lot of products? How many products do they need? And I say need in inverted commas. There's not a lot you need in skincare. There's probably a lot more that you may want, but need is just treating the skin as the organ that it is.
What kind of money do people need to spend? And I'm asking really about women for starters.
Fair. Okay. Oh, do you know what? It depends on who you're talking to. So I'll strip it back and say that the bare necessities for skin to treat it as an organ is to hopefully assume that people are cleansing it, mainly because, for example, a day like today, you might be out and about, you'll have oil naturally secretes onto the skin, you'll have pollution particles that are so microscopic, they sit into the skin unbeknownst to you, whether it's exhaust fumes or even if you're in a rural setting, like I'd live near to kind of, you know, countryside, and there's still fumes and pollution everywhere, let's not lie. Those particles cause inflammation over a period of time. It's really important that we cleanse at the end of the day. So all you really have to do is cleanse every night and ideally cleanse every morning and apply SPF, hail, rain, shine. So to answer your question in that regard, you're talking cleansers can be anything about 20 to 30 euro, probably last you 90 days. Your SPF, again, you're hopefully using a lot more SPF. That's something I'm on a huge mission for. We align very closely with the Irish Cancer Society, and it's all about how much you apply.
And you say every day of the year you should be using that.
So there's different types of lights that penetrate the skin. So for example, even right now in a beautiful studio like this, there's synthetic light. If someone's sitting at home and they have the kitchen light on listening away, that light has high energy visible light. So essentially it's like a form of a blue or a white light. That causes irritation, inflammation and potential pigmentation and acceleration of aging in the skin. So SPF is important whether it's raining outside, whether it's the sunniest day that we're all hoping for and banking for, or whether it's synthetic overhead light. So yes, SPF, sun protection factor, is needed every day. So to answer your question in that regard, you don't have to spend a lot of money on skincare, and that's definitely something I'm a big advocate for. I love TikTok, I love Instagram, I love social media, but it's just over consumerism right now, where people believe they have to have copious amount of products and 16 skincare steps, and they truly don't. So cleansing, SPF, to answer your question, you're probably talking 60 euro, maybe max 70 euro every 3 months. So you do the math, you're talking best part 200 euro a year.
And men and their skin?
Same. So like your skin, if you identify as male, identify as female, we both have skin, we're both exposed to the exact same pollution.
But there's just not the same custom and practice about men taking care of their skin in the same way as women do.
Sean, I'll give you a funny story. So my son recently turned 21 and he had his 21st there in December, and I was walking up the stairs and all of his friends had just come over. They were in my bedroom applying sheet masks and spritzes. And Matthew, I have to say, is quite a quintessential alpha male. And yet that generation, rightly or wrongly, and maybe slightly unfortunately, are quite conscious of their skin, which I don't think is a positive, because sometimes it's just an aesthetic expectation they're placing on themselves. But you're right, there's a lot less conversation on male skincare. But then if you look at the statistics and where that sector is growing globally, it's growing exponentially. Perhaps, and many studies will say, it's because of COVID, where we've now worked predominantly in a more remote setting. Example, people are looking at themselves on Google Meet or Zooms or team meetings, and we're seeing our skin and maybe noticing that it's, you know, quite red or inflamed, or people are conscious of lines and wrinkles. So men are becoming slightly more conscious, I would say, too.
You talk about your son and his generation, but I'm wondering as well about where you draw the line between skincare and the need, the kind of skincare you would provide and recommend, and the need maybe for medical treatment or consultation, because, you know, acne is quite a problem. It's hitting kids at an age where they're very sensitive, they're maturing. And how do you know when to move from one to the other?
Yeah, great question. So with our consultation, so through the Skin Nerd, for example, people fill out a 5-page form. I think we literally ask them everything, Sean, pretty much, like what did you eat for breakfast, digest. So trying to understand skincare isn't just what products people use. It's what's your stress levels? You know, how much time do you spend in front of a screen versus not? How much time are you outdoors? What's your diet like? Is there a lot of essential fatty acids? What's your true answer about how much water you're drinking? Not just your, you know, we'll all say the 2 litres and tell a white lie. So for us, what we do is you screen people first, then you have the consultation. If throughout the consultation, and they send photographs in advance as well, you can tell as a non-qualified medic if it's beyond your remit. And morally and ethically speaking, that's our absolute due diligence to ensure that we say, example, let's say it was yourself, Sean. So Sean will talk you through how to cleanse an SPF and hydrate, but we'll absolutely recommend and encourage you hugely to seek counsel from either your pharmacy if it's needed, or particularly your GP. And then ideally, we'll talk about referring you, or you need to go to GP to get a referral to the dermatologist. So we have dermatologists and doctors that we refer to quite regularly.
How did your parents, how did they respond when you first said you wanted to start your own business?
Sean, it's such a good question. Why? Because I suppose I was reared by, mommy was a banker and daddy worked, I suppose, solid people that had brilliant, good, pensionable jobs. And daddy worked for himself then when he retired, subsequently passed away. So maybe not born entrepreneurs. I think it's a generational piece as well. They were quite scared when I wanted to work in beauty, let alone work for myself, because it didn't have the same, I suppose, security and pieces that they wanted. And
they'd like to have seen you go maybe to university and get a degree in law or whatever it might have
been.
That
was definitely a consideration. So I remember during transition year, I actually went to work in a solicitor's for a week, because that was something I was contemplating at one stage. But beauty just had my heart head over heels, to the point that I worked in a beauty salon part time for free for 2 years in school to ensure that my parents really knew. I say to make sure my parents really knew. I think my parents were cute enough to say that, you know, if you really want to do this, Jennifer, show us. And so I showed them, but actually I was showing myself. So when I worked in a beauty salon for quite a period of time during secondary school without any financial benefit, it was showing me and compounding the fact that, yes, I really did want to do this, because all I could do was cut up cotton wool and make tea, and I do not make a good cup of tea. So there was a lot of learning at that stage. But Matthew then came along into the picture when I was quite young. So I suppose he became the focus of a lot of my life, as you would imagine, as a parent.
Yeah, you became a mother, what, was it in your leaving cert year?
Yeah, I was pregnant during my leaving cert, which I do not advocate for in any shape or form, but that was my reality. And I suppose having had him young then, I worked so hard in my 20s, as many people do, potentially more so. I probably didn't have the typical 20-year-old partying years, because I had a beautiful child at home to care for. That then when I started talking about working for myself so early on that it was inevitable. It was just about getting all the experience. So I believed I needed a solid 10 years behind me in various different areas of business before it was a realistic or a viable option to become self-employed. But it wasn't, I never sat down and said, I'll be self-employed by X stage. It genuinely happened in the most natural, organic evolution of a way, to the point that it probably held me back in business, because it didn't start with a business plan or, you know, understanding my demographic or the sector or the opportunity. That was just, it was from mommy and daddy's dining room table that it all started, with a notepad and pen, and it just grew like a snowball from there. It's only now in later years that I retrospectively have realised and have the right people around me to think, okay, this actually has to be managed like a true company as opposed to a beautiful passion project, which is how it all did start.
Had you worked then for others for a period of several years before you went out on your own?
Yeah, pretty much. So I'd worked in salons, I'd worked in department stores, I'd worked in pharmacy counters, I'd worked travelling around as a representative. I had tried everything from makeup to nails to tan to eyelashes, but always kept coming back to skincare. Baby massage, holistic treatments, aromatherapy. I honestly had tried everything. I suppose where my friends were probably off gallivanting and on their J1, I was working by day to obviously have a salary. But then at night, once Matthew go to bed, I'd study different courses. So it was always an interest in skin.
What was the point where you said, right, I'm ready for this?
I don't think there ever was a point that I said, right, I'm ready for this. I suppose what happened was I was working in London back and forth for the best part of 5 years, which gave me exposure, as I said earlier, to all these different medics, and truly see skin in a different way, not just an aesthetic vanity way, but actually how you could apply skincare that was affordable in a way in which that your skin would respond. So what do I mean by that? I mean, people often love skincare because it feels lovely, it smells lovely. There's a romantic and a psychological relationship that we have with the association of our mom used that product and I remember it as a child, and there's a lot of emotion involved in skincare. But what I really wanted was that people could use products and see a difference with it, like genuinely. So if you've got, people call them age spots or hyperpigmentation or darkening on the skin, people I believe, didn't have to spend copious amount of money to be able to address it, that over a period of time they could use products that would help. So to answer your question, what happened was all that experience became my reality. I was working in Covent Garden. I was skin scanning, which I will explain to you if you like. So skin scanning is, it looks like an old school 1970s television, for want of a better description. You put your head into this, there's technology behind it that essentially allows the practitioner to see not just the skin that we see with the naked eye, but actually the layers below it. So it's almost like a mini x-ray without the x-ray for the skin. So you can see emerging redness that's due to come up in the next 12 months. You can see predicted lines and wrinkles that are going to come through based on the lower layers of the skin. You can see sun damage that's occurred, and so pigmentation, that's a reality. So it's essentially a tool that allows you to see the future. It's almost like a fortune-telling
Might
tool
you,
for skin.
As well as that, though, see things would be the sign of a need to get a medical examination.
Yeah, I've kept in contact with quite a few clients over the years, and there's been many a client that, unfortunately, some have had malignant melanoma, some have had basal cell carcinoma, essentially different forms of skin cancer. So I'm not qualified to diagnose it, never would, but definitely can understand and see the skin and say, Sean, there's something there that I think you need to talk to a doctor about, and I, you know, prioritise it as opposed to waiting for your neck when you're next in. So there's definitely been clients that have come back thankful, grateful, some very reluctant, saying, oh no, that's grand, that comes and goes. And but it was during that time that I realised that, particularly in London, people were spending, I mean, the pounds that were being spent were just eye-watering to me, because I was often serving clinics. So at this stage, to answer your question, I was working for a brand, but my job was to go around to various different clinics to skin scan their clients with the view to educating them on what they needed to use at home. And so when I was working in one particular affluent clinic, my eyes watered at the price that people were happy to spend on eye creams. I just couldn't get my head around it.
Come on, give me a figure or two.
Oh, honestly, you took it, £250, no problem. People would walk away spending £1,200, £1,300.
And you'd be thinking to yourself,
it's just not necessary to spend that much money. So there'd be a little bit of a moral compass shift in my body at times. But what I noticed during that time was people weren't cleansing properly. So cleansing is, I mean, my dad used to always give me the analogy, right? You can't really polish a car or wax a car unless you've washed it, right? Does that make sense? So my argument always was, there's really no point, inverted commas, of spending all this money on all these lotions and potions if you're not cleansing correctly. And what people were doing is they were using, you're talking, what year was this? Maybe 2010, when face wipes were just rampant. Now, they're statistically still growing as a sector, but we don't talk about them as much more from the sustainability side. It's a one use and unfortunately flush, so it doesn't bear well for the environment. But from a skincare perspective, it never did. So I noticed that people were using these face wipes. They were causing irritation and sensitivity to their skin, sometimes inflammation. And so I wanted to create something that would compensate it. And so I started something called the Cleanse Off Mitt. That was the moment that I realised I wanted to create something for myself. But it was a disaster, an absolute epic fail. The worst thing I probably ever did, but the best thing I ever did, all rolled into one. Simply because I was saving, at that stage I was living with my partner at the time, with my son, so we were living together with his family, and Matthew hadn't had his own home yet, and you have beautiful children, you know what it's like when you're rearing them. I just wanted him to have his own bedroom. It's a very simple ask, but I hadn't managed to give him that because I'd had Matt so young, not that that's an excuse, but I hadn't provided for him as I wanted to as a parent. So we'd saved, as many a couple do, we had saved for our first deposit for our house. I decided to create the Cleanse Off Mitt, which was that product I spoke of. It's basically a mitt that takes your makeup off in lieu of a wipe, and it doesn't cause any irritation to the skin, and it's reusable, so it's better for a sustainability point of view. But it needed a bit of investment, as any business does, to get started. So I bought the product, created the product, designed the product, launched it. It did really well. Like, we sold thousands within a couple of weeks. I'd had a distributor represent me, and they'd been so kind to me. But then what started to happen was it sold so well, and I hadn't signed a contract with the distributor, that they noticed the opportunity. Obviously, they had better, you know, setups and so on and so forth. So since learned to read every contract and ask for a contract, but they essentially set it up. And the day that they set up a competing business, unbeknownst to me, was the day that 20,000 mitts had landed into Ireland, which meant that I'd forfeited our deposit for our house so that I could keep going with this business. So we didn't get our house for another 3 or 4 years, back to the drawing board, starting saving again, tail between legs. I'm not going to pretend I was the first in the world to create this mitt. There was many competitors out there. My, I suppose, position was that I was trying to create a really affordable one, whereas most competitors were probably the €20 mark. I launched with the mitt being €5. So Sean, that was a hard... It still is, actually. I have to swallow each time I say it. It's like a hard pill to swallow. So that was a learning for me. We didn't get the house for many a year. And so I was quite burnt by having had my first, I suppose, exposure into the self-employed world. So I was quite hesitant to ever do it again. I was adamant that I would, but with all the learnings that I'd had. Because when you're going into your parents' house, right? When I went into my parents' house, I'd go up to my bedroom, my old bedroom. I'd moved out years prior, but there was just boxes of mitts everywhere. My brother had moved out, boxes of mitts everywhere. Daddy shed. Boxes of mitts everywhere, because we obviously had ordered the mitts, then the distributor had set up their competitor business. I didn't have the ability to continue ploughing money into it, so I just was left with 20,000 mitts for a period of years, sitting as a physical representation of the ill decisions and the lack of structure I'd put into my life. But we got the house, so that was the emotional win, and then at that stage felt more safe, and then opportunities arose.
The support of your family must have been very important to you then, particularly during that particular downtime.
Yeah, very much so, Sean, but I'm spoiled rotten. I'm the most loved child, I think. I mean, I'm 40 now and I just still think I'm just loved beyond belief. So yeah, I would call mommy and daddy. I'm not allowed to call them mom and dad, which I don't know if it bodes well when you do podcasts like this in your 40s. It sounds so juvenile, but yeah, they were phenomenal. They were honestly a rock of strength when I had Matthew so young. They were literally like co-parents. Matthew's dad is very active in his life, but I suppose I was still so young. We weren't a couple, so they were my unit. And then fast forward to the stage you speak of now, starting to work for myself. So they had just retired. So they picture this, they had their whole lives ahead of them. They're in their 60s, they'd worked really hard and they were looking forward to this life together. And then I decided to interrupt by saying, I'm going to start this business. It did so well that I was working full time for a skincare company back in Ireland at this stage. I was no longer over and back to London. And it was doing so well that I couldn't keep up with the demand at night. I'd since separated from that previous partner. It was just Matthew and I at home in the house on my own. I didn't have the luxury of trying to, you know, I had to pay the bills. But so they helped me. They actually gave up their retirement to do all of this
and
in a labour of love.
There was the very sad time your father passed away. That obviously would have had a huge impact on you personally, but you would have missed his support professionally, I would have thought as well. His background was legal, right?
Yeah, exactly. So at this stage, they were driving up, like daddy, so mommy would take all the orders from the pharmacies and by shorthand, and then daddy would pack them up. Like this was not his skill set. He'd pack them up and they'd drive up and down to the post office. They'd go out to the storage units, they'd bring it. So they were literally my customer service, logistics department. Everything was done by pen and paper. No, there was an I wasn't a scrap of anything done by a computer. My son would come home from secondary school. My parents used to mind my son after school. Matthew'd be sent down on his bike with the late arrivals of the orders. So like it was a very much a true, like absolutely started from the dining room table with a labour of love by my parents. They got paid in hugs. They still are. My mom still has a book of the arrears of all the hugs that she's still overdue and unfortunately daddy never got to get. But yeah, to answer your question, daddy was hugely important. Unfortunately, daddy passed away about a year into the Skin Nerd. So I never really got to feel the true benefit of all of his knowledge. One of my last genuine prominent memories of him is I'd had an operation and he was in doing his great daddy duties of, you know, accompanying me post-surgery, and he read me the Company Law Act, which was took hours. So I was, in the most respectful way, sorry for anyone else, because daddy helped write it. I was bored out of my absolute tree. So it was probably the best thing that could have happened, because I was in and out of consciousness and listening to him, and he was so adamant that I would learn everything about company law so that I was set up for a success.
He really picked his moment, didn't he?
I was on morphine, Sean. So like, I mean, I was, yeah, I've actually gone on to since read it. So I would know it a lot better now. But a lot of that, I suppose, inspired me to, I would have gone to him for a lot of legal advice, would have gone to him about shareholdings and constitutions and shareholder agreements and, you know, different options and offers, because people were approaching me to invest in the company. I didn't quite know how to manage it. So he was literally my rock, my source of truth. And not only did he care for the business and its success, but as every parent does, he cared for me. So there was a very biased approach insofar as that he wanted to mind my back, because people were potentially a lot more seasoned than I, so weren't maybe proposing the best opportunities for me, but for them, which I understand is business. And so yeah, losing him was, of course, as a child, you miss your daddy no matter what. And then I felt very much for Matthew, because Matthew's only 15 and he was reared like daddy was like a second father to him. So yeah.
You mentioned surgery there, Jennifer. Throughout all of this and for many years before, you were struggling with a debilitating health condition, endometriosis. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so endometriosis, 1 in 10 women, I think are the stats in Ireland, tend to suffer with it. It's quite a silent illness insofar as that my understanding as a lay person as opposed to a medic is that you have to have what's called a laparoscopy or keyhole surgery to be able to decipher if it truly is endometriosis. endometriosis. There's no blood test or scan that can say that it is or isn't definitively. So because I suppose the joy of having had Matthew Young was that I was in that system an awful lot sooner than you typically might be. So postpartum, I had suffered quite a lot with my womb, with periods. And maybe when Matthew was three, so I was about 21 at this stage, my periods were excruciating. And so I did get a laparoscopy because I was within the remit. They could see the difference of my cycle, if you will, having gone back for checkups and so on and so forth. And having not had him, I wouldn't have known it. So I got the diagnosis, but ignorantly, goodness, when I think back now, she took nearly two decades ago, I was told your cysts were taken, your fibroids were taken away, and your endometriosis is gone. So I thought, oh, brilliant, like that's it, it's gone. I never really realised that it was a lifelong piece, that it would come back. So once it's excised or removed, it still has the ability to return. So thankfully, it's not sinister, but it does affect your quality of life. So not just your womb area, but affects your bowel, constipation, everything that comes with, like, I suppose, an underactive or an overactive bowel area. It affected a large part of IBS, just an awful lot of food, inflammation, irritation. So it wasn't something I associated as that being the main reality until maybe I got to 30. So perhaps 9 years after a couple of surgeries, I unfortunately started to really suffer again, would faint, would have a lot of blood loss, ended up in Beaumont a good few times, would be referred over to a maternity hospital. And then fast forward to the last 18 months, which then ultimately realised that, as my gynaecologist eventually put it, you're an enigma. Your womb just doesn't want to stay in your body. There's no other reality except for we have to remove it, simply because, not at the endometriosis, can I make that really clear, there was an awful lot of other pieces happening, cysts, fibroids, and where they were attached to just ultimately meant that if they kept removing them, they'd have to take my womb due to where it was positioned in the womb and the blood source.
So you ended up with a fairly radical decision at a stage in life when you wouldn't expect it to have to take it.
It definitely put a timeline on from a fertility conversation. You know, would you like to have more children? Would you not? That became our reality very much last year. And I suppose the added layer of complexity is I'm married to a woman, so you can't try. You have to very much make a purposeful decision as to whether you'd like to have children, because obviously you need to have IVF involved or IUI or you know, assistance in some form. So yeah, look, Sean, it was probably the hardest time, but I didn't realise it was until I'm now past it and I realise the quality of life as I zip and nip through life. And I'm delighted to, it was a big decision to make, but I almost didn't have the decision anymore. It was taken. And my quality of life now is tenfold by comparison. But the hardest part, I would say, for any female listeners is, and where I have a huge amount of empathy, and often they say you don't understand till you've walked it. And sometimes I agree with that and sometimes I don't, but they put me into medical menopause. And I would have always spoken about menopause in a skin capacity, what happens, what the impact of the hormone decline, etc. would have. But then having lived, being medically induced into menopause in a space of 12 hours, it was just where women will often segue into that over a period of 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. Having it within a 12-hour period was definitely literally like night and day. And it was almost like looking into the future, seeing what my life would be, because I was only put into it for a 4-month window. And it was the hardest thing I've personally gone through, because it was almost like hormones on, hormones off. And then really appreciating the role that they have in your body, in your life, in your attitude, in your energy, in your mental health. It is significant. So I have so much more love, attention and desire to talk about menopause from a skin perspective, having lived it for 4 months of the last 6 months. So yeah, my heart goes out to anyone that has had to do it. And unfortunately, most people that have to go into induced medical menopause are doing it for sinister reasons. I wasn't. So I'm also very aware that I was fortunate that it was just to get me through the menopause, to get me through the hysterectomy.
You mentioned about being married to a woman. Now, that was a wedding that took place relatively recently in the last several months. It may well have come as a surprise to people who have known you back to your childhood that you would get married to a woman.
Yeah, very much. I think the person that was most surprised was myself. Had Matthew, as I mentioned already, was in a relationship with a gentleman for 9 years, truly saw my life path ahead, thought that this was it. You know, it was the 2.4 and, you know, children and, you know, everything was kind of as you've been reared. And then a different person to who I'm married to really took my interest and intrigue. She was a lady. And I suppose it has turned my world upside down, because you kind of think when you get to 29, you have a good sense of who you are, what you want, how you want to be in the world, what you're looking for from the world, and how you'd like to show up. And so when I started becoming intrigued in this particular lady, it just threw my world upside down. Friends at the time, you know, joked and said I was having a midlife crisis. I was just allergic to commitment. There was loads of different thoughts and processes. But ultimately, having then broken up with my partner of the 9 year period, just took time, took 5-6 years to try and decide, where is my life going? Who am I? And I think when I look back on, because I love journaling, if I look back to journals at that time, I lost all confidence in myself completely, because I felt that if I didn't know what gender or sex I wanted to be with for the rest of my life, what else did I not know about myself? And it's not to put this on Matthew at all, but I wonder if, because I didn't have the 20s that many do and maybe explored and gallivanted and was curious, I just, as soon as Matthew was born, I wanted to give him safe, solid. And so safe, solid represented as man, woman, child. And that's what I wanted for him. And it wasn't until later that I questioned it, I suppose.
And do you think that if the crisis hadn't happened in the business and, you know, you were left with these 20,000 myths that you had to pay for, that the house deposit went into, that you would have got married to the male partner and perhaps had more children and on you would have gone?
I honestly don't know. Like, it's generally like, there's so many scenarios in your life you look back at and you think, I wonder. But I don't believe I was, I mean, that gentleman who isn't Matthew's biological father, but was 9 years his, you know, acting father, if you will, in addition to his biological father, he's still very much a large presence in Matthew's life. He's a beautiful soul and a lovely man. We weren't destined to be together. And then when I had those few years having broken up with him and trying to explore and understand and question and went to counselling, I mean, honestly, the bills and counselling I've been to over the years is extortionate. But all, I suppose, with a view to making me stronger, clearer, and what would I like. I had really, I suppose, and this tends to offend people, so I never mean to offend people, but I had decided I'd rather stay in a heterosexual relationship because my experience of being in a same-sex couple wasn't the kindest at times. People are more past remarkable. Security can be questioned at times. People ask the most invasive questions because they believe it's okay to do so, albeit that they're curious. It's still nothing I would ask.
And would these be questions
couple.
From friends?
More so people that would be friends of friends. So, for example, you might be at a wedding and people, obviously, you know, you're at a table together, you're destined to be friends for the next couple of hours, right? So the questions are usually, what do you do for a living? And then, oh, are you together? And then there'd be a lot of questions as drink would start to happen. And it just didn't sit well with me, probably because I hadn't fully committed to being in the same sex in my head. And so I decided, right, heterosexual life was going to be for me simply because it was easier. That's the cop-out answer, but that's what I felt.
But the questions were there, were they, in your mind?
I wasn't sure. I generally wasn't sure. And so all the different counselling I went through, there were some great counsellors, there were some questionable counsellors. I remember at one stage, one counsellor saying to me, I don't believe that women are gay. I believe that women mistrust men. And that was obviously quite a large one to process, because then you're going home thinking, God, do I mistrust men? And I didn't. Like, I had the most phenomenal father. Daddy was, like, genuinely the most beautiful soul and just could not have been more loved. I have a beautiful brother. So there's just a lot of, I suppose what I probably say to people next, people do come to me a lot saying, God, I love that you came out later. I love that you figured out. How did you figure it out? I don't know how to do it. And I always say, you just have to get the right people around you, because I don't know if I always did.
And had the thought not crossed your mind, maybe in your later teenage years, before the birth of your son, that maybe you were bisexual or lesbian or whatever?
No, and like, Sean, I suppose you're thinking about what would it have been. Like, I did my leaving cert 2003, so 20 odd years ago. But ultimately, there was almost no representation. And I don't mean, like, obviously some people instinctively know. Like, my wife, Jill, said she never was attracted to a man in her life. It just wasn't in her. Whereas I felt that, you know, I did find men attractive. So I definitely wouldn't fall into the quintessential knowing from birth person. But I just, there was no women out there. I knew men could be gay, but I didn't even generally know that women could be gay. So it was Ellen DeGeneres in a public setting. It's probably the first woman that I would have been aware of that liked women, which sounds so unbelievable now, because there's so many people represented. And now, you know, there's months of pride and there's so many different people within the LGBTQIA plus community, but just didn't feel like it was myself. Mm. And it was genuinely, like, as I said, the biggest surprise was when I realised, goodness, I think I have got feelings. And I work in a predominantly female sector. So for me, it was just a genuine out of the blue. How did you not know this about yourself? What else do you not know? How can you trust yourself? If you don't know that at your own core, what else do you not know? Are you actually a good person? Are you kind? Are you everything you fed yourself and believe you are? So the counselling was less always about my sexuality and more so truly trying to actually know yourself for who you are, not the person you've told you yourself you are? Because I think that happens a lot in life. Mm. We're told and conditioned by our family that we're a certain person. Then we go to a workforce and we're told something again. Mm. And that's a constant narration that's fed to us. But actually, I believe we should be in control of our own narration as to who we truly are.
And were you still with the person you describe as your gentleman partner at the time when you began to have questions about your sexuality?
He observed it. He was the one that probably called it out and said, Jen, I think you need to think about this. And we were very serious at that stage. So when I say that man is a remarkable man, I generally mean that man is a remarkable man.
What did he see?
He just saw that I was intrigued. And so say a friendship that I thought was quite platonic, which it was, I would be quite upset if that particular person was no longer able to make a gym session if we were going to it together, or if they were set to go on holidays, I'd miss them. Whereas I have my best friend in the whole wide world, Sinead, if she went on holidays with her husband tomorrow, I'd be like, brilliant, send me photographs. Like, it'd be, you know, it's a normal friendship. So it was he that would have spotted it. So it was a very difficult time for him, for the learning. So it was about separating and parting amicably as we could. And then I had to set upon with different, and I leaned on counselling immediately because I didn't know who else to turn to. Like, how do you figure this out? So there was a lot within it. But fast forward to today, and my son's 21. My wife is amazing. Business is going well. I do think these setbacks happen so that you can enjoy things when they truly are in a great place.
And strange to relate, you met your now wife, Jill, during COVID when it wasn't particularly easy to meet people.
Yeah, so true. Well, I actually met her just prior to that, to be fair. But yes, you're right. We started what we would call online courting during the depths of COVID. We'd met at a panel the summer prior. We were both on an entrepreneur, but she owns her own company. I own my own company. We were both on a panel together and just a natural, I suppose, respect set up. And then fast forward to friendship emerging. It was then genuinely, goodness, if I bring everyone back and forth to you tomorrow, 2020, the COVID restrictions had just started. And so we lived too far apart to be able to meet up. But it was a genuine friendship. And then it just blossomed into more. I would often say it's almost like an old school traditional courting, but in the most current setting that we had to talk on Zoom or FaceTime. So I got to fall in love with her brain because we couldn't see each other. And then honestly think I felt I really fell in love with her soul and her being. So then when the restrictions lifted in June, we were finally able to go on our first actual date. So there was kind of two stages to our relationship. So the person first and then the body second, if you will.
And when it came to looking for a best man, you didn't have to look very far, did it?
No, I asked my son to be my best man. So he was my best man for our wedding, which is nearly a year ago now. So yeah, it feels like a million years ago.
How then at this stage do you manage the demands, or how do you balance a personal life with the demands of running a public facing brand?
I don't know if there truly, and I know this answer is said so many a time, but I just don't know if there is a balance. I think you can do, so example, Monday, Tuesday this week for me were quite intense work days. So it means that I know there isn't going to be a lot of gym time. There isn't going to be social time. It's just truly committed to work. But then example, the tail end this week, I will work a few less hours on Friday and we'll have a lovely, there's a birthday in the family, so we'll have a celebratory dinner. So I believe I look at a week and within a month and go, right, okay, well, X amount of days are going to be solely work. And then the other days will be more of a balance and some days will be more solely personal. And that's how I balance it out. Mm-hmm. I think it's different now when Matthew's older, but definitely I feel for people that are trying to balance the young family and the work life and the social life and that's what I look at with most of my friends. They're all having kids that are probably the oldest is 10 down to like just true newborn, and they're trying to juggle seeing us as friends in addition, and it's just not possible. So I think that balance is, what's the balance for you at this given moment in time, depending on all of the asks you have on your life.
And how do you see the future then for your company? Can it get much bigger? Do you have plans for world domination? Do you employ the 28 people? They're all your employees. I mean, there's quite a lot of gathering again, that kind of payroll. So do you have an expansion plan?
Because it started off at the dining room table, and it's only in the last years that it's become a true business. I suppose, what is it, my true business? It was always a business, but I didn't really, it was just such a labour of love. It just kind of grew organically, as I said. It's only of late that I've kind of sat down and said, okay, what way do you run a true business? So what I mean by that is really learning the scope of the sector, the opportunity within it. And so we do have plans to export, to liaise, to retail outside of Ireland. But at the moment, there's still so much more I can do in Ireland. So our market share is significant for the size that we are, for the years that we are, for the fact that we're not a conglomerate, that we're very much an indie, and it's all, you know, funded by ourselves. But ultimately, I feel I have a job to do to educate people more here before I could spread those 28 people and their attention into a new market. So truth be told, we started trying to sell into the UK during COVID. I tried to do a lot during COVID, Sean, upon reflection. But ultimately, it just, I ignorantly did not realise how much, how many people I needed on the ground, how much investment you truly need to be able to enter into a new sector. I suppose because a lot of our love comes from, like, people adore Skin Ingredients. Our retention rate is far beyond the norm of the industry standard. And we've just been spoiled rotten by the love of Ireland. And I think it's because the products truly work. If you see our packaging, it actually looks quite youthful. So for someone who's, say, 40 and above, they might look at it and think, oh, that's for someone younger. But actually the ingredients inside are, so they always say what's inside that counts, we're so potent. So I just need to amalgamate a lot of my learnings before I would then look to try to export or enter into the UK market. But we're often approached by UK retailers and further afield. And there's this big dangling carrot of beautifulness that I would love to one day reach out to, but I generally feel there's the more systems, protocols, the correct people, structure I have to put in place before I would truly make that leap.
It sounds like, though, that there are expansion opportunities there waiting to be exploited, should you decide.
Should we decide? If I'm being really truthful, I think because I tried so hard all those years ago, the Cleanse Off Mitt, and then, you know, competition took over and that caused me to go backwards. And then I suppose because we tried to dabble into the UK, I probably had two setbacks that I've had so much learning that I've had to look in the mirror and think, OK, I can launch somewhere else now, but do I have enough of the systems in place to truly keep Ireland growing at its potential rate? And so right now it's all about listening to our Irish clients, ensuring they get the results they deserve, learning and populate, you know, really focusing on our regional ability, and then potentially in the not so distant future thinking, OK, with all those learnings, with this new revised business case, with the massive opportunity that is beyond Ireland, because Ireland is almost like you're forgiven here, people accept you here, I can make so many, I don't want to say mistakes, but so many learnings. So I think until we're in that complete place of strength, I'd be reluctant to bring us
elsewhere. Would you be looking to meet maybe with consultants or Enterprise Ireland, or to get that kind of advice that's available to guide you through or to help you find your way or to navigate through the whole expansion idea?
Enterprise Ireland, we're a client of theirs and have been for years, and they just always, in the most beautiful way, that we've the most amazing manager that we work with. But she is always baffled because she'll come with, Jennifer, this opportunity, this trade show, this, and I always say, not quite yet, not quite yet, not quite yet. So where I suppose I generally believe in life, you have to learn to walk before you can run. And I think what's often celebrated in an entrepreneurial spirit is if you're running before you're walking. And I've done that, Sean, and it hasn't always landed well. You'll have more concerns. You learn the hard way. So I'm very much about slow.
It sounds like that 20,000 surplus, or at least unsold or undistributed myths has seared something into your soul.
Genuinely. I just look, I really mean it. Like I do it myself. I look at other businesses and they're, you know, in this country and that country and shipping it everywhere. And it is so exciting. And that's their business plan. But mine is, no, Ireland has so much opportunity. People deserve great skincare here. I've got an amazing rock solid team. Let's get that completely tight knit.
I know you're concentrating on skincare and that's what your products are, but there is that element of, if you like, filler and Botox, which seems to be quite common among, well, mainly women, I think, possibly some men as well. What's your take on all of that?
It's definitely growing exponentially. There's no denying it. I see them as two separate entities under the same umbrella. What I mean by that is the aesthetics or the injectables are, I suppose, putting product into the face with a view to looking more youthful, whereas skincare is something that's, I suppose, to look after the skin, but they don't do the same thing. What I mean is a lot of our clients who come to us and say, I'm contemplating having neurotoxin, which is the brand name is Botox for a lot of people. And so they often, example, could be 40, and then they'll make their muscle look a lot more static and younger, but then the skin on top can look slightly their age or potentially older based on their sun damage. And so that's when you have that distorted look that people tend to then notice if it is a Botox or whatever. So I would say to people, they're not exclusive. They're definitely something you can look at together. But skincare, first and foremost, is the respectful piece to look after the skin. It deserves that respect. And when you get an injection, it doesn't help the discoloration. It doesn't help the texture, the roughness, the dryness, the oiliness. So don't see them as the same thing. See them as two separate pieces. I would always encourage people to do skincare as a non-negotiable, not just because I'm in it, but because skin is an organ. And then if you decide to go down the injectable road, just go to someone so qualified with a portfolio, the most qualified person you can find, as opposed to someone that does it in addition to their day job, which unfortunately is becoming the reality, and it's not as regulated as you would think, hope, and assume. So do your research.
Finally, looking ahead, what's next for you both on a personal and professional level?
Oh, goodness. On a personal level, in the not-so-distant future, I'm actually looking forward to having not a lot planned, Sean. We've had the most amazing year between, we had two engagements, we had two hens, we had actually three hens, we had two weddings. There was it was over the top. It was dramatic. It was all love is love. So for this year, we're just enjoying the peace of not having something on every weekend. Isn't that the testament to being old, is that you're just looking forward to a weekend where you're staying in? And then from a professional perspective, there is generally a lot happening. There's a lot of newness, there's a lot of innovation. We've just launched a new website. So you're just constantly yearning and working towards more.
Jennifer Rock, the Skin Nerd, thank you so much indeed for joining me on the Insights Podcast.
Thank you, Sean.
And that was the final episode for now in this series. To hear more, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. There you'll find a whole range of episodes with our wonderful guests who share their insights, including disability campaigner and entrepreneur Sinead Burke on making it an accessible world for everyone and the conversation she's having at events for Vogue and the Met Gala. Social media star and breast cancer survivor Georgie Crawford on the real cost of surrogacy. And you'll find out too why I'm now one of her followers. Plus many, many more. And remember, please follow the series to be alerted when new episodes become available.